And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and around the region this Thursday, October 26th, 2023. Sudanese activists are hoping the renewed talks in Saudi Arabia will convince the warring parties to lay down their guns.
There is no other choice, and I believe this is the only peaceful way to engage the two warring parties since they have the upper hand in the country at the moment.
And a South Sudan official blames disputes between the parties to the peace deal for delays in reforming independent commissions.
Other parties in the agreement wanted us to divide everything, even when they are not mentioned in the agreement to be shared. That includes Beirut's cooperatives, corporations, councils, you name them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some Sudanese civil society activists are welcoming the resumption of talks today between Sudan's armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. One Sudanese women's activist says she is hopeful that this time around, the two rival parties will reach an agreement to end the conflict and restore stability across the country. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs issued a statement Thursday welcoming Sudan's two rival groups for talks in Jeddah after months of suspension. A statement from the ministry states, quote, "The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia welcomes the resumption of talks between the warring sides." The statement also called on the negotiators to abide by an earlier agreement announced on May 11th for the protection of civilians and a short-term ceasefire deal signed on May 20th. The statement further said, quote, "The kingdom affirms its keenness on unity of rungs to stop the bloodshed and alleviate the suffering of the Sudanese people," end quote. Both the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces accepted the invitation to resume negotiations in Jeddah. The Sudan Armed Forces announced on its official X or Twitter account that its representatives are already in Jeddah to participate in the expected talks. The Rapid Support Forces also stated their readiness to participate in the Jeddah talks. Suad Musa, a resident of Kassala town of eastern Sudan, says both the Sudan Armed Forces and the RSF have no other choice but to sit down and address the root causes of the conflict. Musa told VOA via a messaging application that rival groups should silence the guns and end the ongoing violence.
There is no other choice, and I believe this is the only peaceful way to engage the two warring parties since they have the upper hand in the country at the moment. They need to realize that there are others who also need to live in Sudan.
Sudanese activist Asad Atahir, who resides in the Ugandan capital Kampala, says he also welcomes the resumption of talks in Jeddah. Speaking to VOA via a messaging application from Kampala, Atahir says he remains hopeful that the Jeddah talks will bear fruit.
I expect that the mediators will present some solutions to both sides after they go through the stance of the two sides. But the most important and urgent at the moment is to reach a humanitarian agreement to safeguard the arrival of humanitarian aid to all the needy in Sudan.
Sudanese writer Meki Al-Maghribi says negotiations is the only suitable way to end Sudan's conflict. Speaking from Port Sudan earlier today, Al-Maghribi told VOA that there is a need for the two sides to recommit to a ceasefire and allow humanitarian access.
Peace talks highly recommended between army, RSF, political powers. Jeddah Forum, the efforts of United States of America, Saudi Arabia, are based on a clear humanitarian declaration. That is good.
Representatives of the African Union and the East Africa Bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, are expected to attend the Jeddah talks. A group called the Civil Front to halt the war and restore democracy in Sudan met in Addis Ababa Monday to discuss how to end the ongoing conflict in Sudan. According to the United Nations, more than 9,000 people have been killed, while some 5.6 million people have been displaced from their homes since conflict broke out in mid-April. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The parties that signed South Sudan's revitalized peace deal have done very little to reform dozens of independent national and state commissions as required by the peace agreement. South Sudan's cabinet affairs minister says disagreements over how to proceed with the reforms has slowed the process. Waki Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan's Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lomuro, says the parties have completed work on 17 commissions identified in the peace agreement. He says the parties have agreed to start work on the National Elections Commission, the National Constitution Review Commission, and the Political Parties Council. He says some of the parties have already submitted names of their representatives for appointment to the commissions.
All the other parties in the agreement wanted us to divide everything, even when they are not mentioned in the agreement to be shared. That includes bureaus, cooperatives, corporations, councils, you name them. And we said some of these organizations are not political organizations. They are civil servants. There is no way we can subject our civilians to political division. It will cause disharmony, but they are supposed to be occupied through meritology.
Lamakol Ajawin, the Secretary General and a spokesperson of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, Oshawa, confirms the parties have agreed to reconstitute their commissions, adding that his alliance has also submitted names for appointment to the commissions.
The same delay that caused the delay for constituting the presidency, constituting the council of ministers, constituting the governments of the state. All these should have finished within the first 8 months of the what they used to call the pre-transitional period. Well, I think it is mainly the lack of political will that caused the delay.
A senior member of a group known as the Other Political Parties, or OPP, confirms the transitional government of National Unity agreed to reconstitute 17 commissions earmarked in the peace agreement. Paulino Lukudu says blame games by some signatories of the 2018 peace deal delayed the implementation of reforms stipulated in the agreement.
There is a deficiency in the political trust. The mistrust is not among all the parties. The mistrust is among putting things according to the time frame in the roadmap. Because I don't see there is a reason of us being so much behind the roadmap.
Pauk Botha Baluang, acting spokesperson in the office of the first vice president Riek Machar, told the VOA the parties have agreed to work on Elections Commission, Political Parties Council, and the National Constitutional Review Commission.
We did not receive any justifications on why the delayment has occurred after almost this time, because it has been an habit to the IG to complain that the IO, they are the one now delaying and so on and so forth. So our list has been sent.
Philip Anyang, a policy analyst with the Juba-based non-profit Advocates Without Borders, says the parties should show political will and address the issues hindering the completion of the matrix defined in the roadmap on the implementation of the agreement.
Instead, the parties are focused on issues that do not add value to the agreement itself. I know there are challenges. First of all, we've talked of resources that are not in place to put these institutions in place. Secondly, we know very well the will of the parties has been zero from day one. No one is willing to ensure this agreement is being implemented. Other than that, the principals are looking at what benefits them, what benefits the parties, but not in the interest of South Sudanese.
South Sudan's 2018 peace agreement identified 60 independent commissions, including other institutions, for reforms after the establishment of the Transitional Government of National Unity was formed in 2020. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some South Sudanese lawmakers and members of the organized forces are raising concerns over what they call irregularities in the payment of salaries under a new structure that allows for a 400% pay increase, which takes into account the country's soaring inflation. They say some members of the organized forces are receiving salaries that exceed the 400% increment agreed to in the current fiscal year budget, while other organized forces, including a component of the necessary unified forces from the opposition, have not been paid. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
Last week, members of South Sudan Organized Forces received salaries based on new structure reflecting a 400% increment. Lawmaker Guy Mayen says Ministry of Finance should explain why it paid salaries higher than what was approved in the recent budget.
It is not a 400% salary increment which is being given out. We are asking the Minister of Finance, how is it able to pay the army outside the budget? And yet the parliament was humiliated to abandon the proposal, which was actually more generous, which was more reasonable, because there was supposedly no money. So where does the money come from? Out of the blue, to pay a private in the army 39,000. And yet as of the increment of 400%, a private in the army is supposed to be receiving 10,000.
The spokesperson of South Sudan People Defense Forces, or SSPDF, Major General Lu Rai Kong, confirms members of the organized forces received more than the approved 400% increase. Kong says after lawmakers approved the 2023-2024 fiscal year budget, the SSPDF leaders adjusted its salary scale to match civil servants' pay. He says that adjustments were made based on a number of considerations, such as years spent in one rank and time of service.
Salary is based on ranking system. It is not yet based on qualification. And the number of courses you have undertaken and the duration of service in general and the number of years spent in one rank. In the whole world, pay is based on some of these pre-requirements are meant. So when the Minister of Labor sat, our grades were unified with civil servant grades, and a private was promoted from being 17 grade to 14, and it went across like that.
Lawmaker Mayen says he is disappointed to learn about the irregularity and inequality among members of the organized forces.
But if at this time the army is still divided, there is an army which is being paid and the other army is not being paid, then that means we still don't have a unified national army of this country. And that really sends a very wrong message.
Kong says the irregularities in payment of some organized forces are not intentional. He says members of the necessary unified forces from the oppositions have not been paid because they did not identify and submit names of commanders from the smallest formation to brigade level to the president for confirmation so that they could be included in the budget.
They were not also submitted to His Excellency the President so that they are confirmed as officers and NCOs in the National Army. Then after they were graduated, because no detailed information was submitted in terms of their rank system, their name, the position they would occupy, it delayed. And after graduation, because of lack of all this information, they were not budgeted for by NTC.
However, the spokesperson of the former rebels of the Sudan People Liberation Army, or SPLAIO, Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, says the peace agreement does not specify any preconditions for salary payment.
There was no any condition that was supposed to be met. The only condition met was that they were unified, both in military formation, graduated. Who again below the president can decide to say that there is condition need to be met? Not there. I don't believe there was any other condition that was supposed to be met prior to them being paid. All they want was a list of these forces to be given, but this was already given a long time ago, and they were supposed to be budgeted for immediately.
Kosti Manibe, a member of the former detainees, says he believes that once the forces are unified under one command, they are entitled to get payment together.
The agreement simply talks of unifying the forces within a specified period of time. So all that remains is the criteria for those who would not become that unified army. You see, once an agreement has been signed, these forces are going to be brought together. And in my view, from that time, they are one. They should be entitled to exactly the same treatment.
South Sudan in Focus reach out to South Sudan Minister of Finance Bakbar Nabachol for comments on the payments of the National Army, but he declined to speak. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, the World Bank says a few African countries are enjoying fairly good economies this year. But what about the others? Stay tuned to find out. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Kenya, Rwanda, and Cote d'Ivoire have been among the fastest-growing economies on the African continent in 2023, according to a new World Bank report. The report attributes strong economic performance in those three countries to a number of factors, including sound macroeconomic policies and investments in infrastructure. But Harry Verhoeven, a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, tells me that it's not so much what those countries did right as much as what countries like South Africa, Sudan, and Nigeria have done wrong.
Because what really stands out when you look at the last couple of years, but including 2023, is the underperformance of some of Africa's big economies. And that, of course, also brings down not only average growth rates, but most importantly, things like job creations, which is really above all what Africa needs, and which the World Bank in its latest report rightly underscored should be the absolute priority of policymakers. So, yeah, Kenya, Rwanda, Cote d'Ivoire are posting decent returns, but even there, it must be noted that those growth rates really should be significantly higher. I'm thinking here 6-7% if they are to make a dent in unemployment, particularly youth unemployment.
It said that there's a group of other countries that stand out as pretty good performers, including Ethiopia, Uganda, Benin, Botswana, even the DRC, where there's been a lot of conflict. How do you read that?
Well, there is some growth in, for example, a place like Ethiopia and Congo. And some of that, like in the case of Ethiopia, is kind of a return after some years of horrific economic results and horrific humanitarian crisis and conflict. So almost always you get this kind of rebound effect. But again, in those kinds of countries too, what we really would need to see for a transformation of these economies to happen, for meaningful creation of opportunities for people in cities, as well as crucially in the countryside, is sustained growth, for example, over a period of a decade of 6-7%. Now, Ethiopia used to have that prior to 2018 and the political transition, the turbulence, the war then. Ethiopia did post very impressive results that were also coupled with very important social advances. For example, in decreasing neonatal mortality, in giving people increased access to medication with HIV/AIDS, road construction, connecting people to the grid, those kinds of things. Now, with the current kind of growth trajectory that we're seeing, that's unlikely to happen. It's unlikely to happen for two reasons. One is that it simply doesn't generate enough tax revenues for potentially the state to drive forward these agendas. Nor do we see the private sector, the formal private sector, actually growing enough, again, to create the kind of jobs that would meaningfully transform what ordinary Africans have in terms of disposable income. And so this latest report in many ways is sobering because, as I said, even the good performers or those that are seen as doing relatively well are kind of more doing okay.
Despite political tensions in Kenya, let's focus on Kenya. Its growth remains strong, and it's even seen as the economic engine of Africa. I've heard it referred to like that. Why can't other African countries follow in Kenya's footsteps?
Well, Kenya does a number of basic things, I think, quite well, and those are important indeed for kind of sustained growth. Again, not as high as ITU would like to see or as perhaps the Kenyan government would like to see, but a relative degree of political stability. As you know, since the very contested election of 2007-2008 in Kenya, it's had a number of very closely fought elections, but none of these have really led to the kind of major political violence that we saw 15 years ago. So the fact that Kenya's political elites do manage to come to some degree of compromise and kind of collectively decide at least not to sink the economy, or at least not to kind of torpedo the political stability of the country, as happened, for example, in Sudan or Ethiopia, certainly helps. Two, what Kenya does have that is also quite important and sometimes different from other African states is a profound respect property and associated with that monetary policy as pursued by the central bank.
That is Harry Verhoeven. He's a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He was speaking with me from New York. Malawi is seeking a spike in cholera cases. This just 2 months after the government lifted a public health emergency declaration that had been in place since early 2022. Chimwemwe Padatha has the story from Lilongwe, Malawi.
2 months after Malawi's Ministry of Health declared cholera no longer a national public health emergency, the country is seeing an upsurge of cholera cases. Health rights activist George Jobe says a more relaxed attitude to cholera prevention measures is behind the increase.
After the cases went low and the people stopped dying, and the Minister of Health communicated that cholera was no longer a public threat, at that point, indeed, we have seen people relaxing. Issues of hand washing with soap have simmered down. So that relaxation is indeed very true.
Access to clean water among Malawians in rural areas remains a challenge. And according to the government, a majority of people in remote areas of the country rely on wells or boreholes for their water. The government is now requiring that all wells and boreholes comply with government safe water regulations by the end of this month. Masozi Kasambara from Malawi's National Water Resource Authority says these water sources are often contaminated.
Of the 44 boreholes that we sampled, 33 of the same, which represents 75% of the sampled boreholes, had its water biologically contaminated.
The new regulation is frustrating to people like Gloria Yoda from Chimpumbulu village in Lilongwe, who says it is costly and does not give them enough time to comply.
We depend on this groundwater. This is not realistic as most houses cannot afford annual subscriptions for the boreholes. We ask the government to withdraw the ultimatum.
Malawi's Ministry of Health has since launched a new cholera prevention campaign in October to contain further spread of the disease, which is most prevalent in the rainy season, running from November to April.
Cholera campaign aimed at preventing the similar situation. And apart from that, we are making sure that we are upping the game. We are now on the ground sensitizing the people on the importance of upholding high levels of hygiene and sanitation. We are also distributing chlorine.
Since March 2022, cholera has killed over 1,700 people in Malawi. Chimwemwe Padatha, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
Turning to the Middle East now, deaths are adding up by the thousands, and tragic images from both sides of the Gaza conflict are circulating on Palestinian and Israeli social media, fueling mutual hatred that is becoming more ingrained as the conflict deepens. Jan Bochot spoke with both sides in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Marcus Harton narrates this story for us.
The violence has been nonstop as Israeli warplanes bomb Gaza, while Hamas continues to fire rockets into Israel. West Bank protests broke out after last Friday's prayers, and confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinians left several dead. For the first time in almost 20 years, Israeli jets attacked a West Bank town. On the border with Lebanon, violence is also escalating, raising concerns on both sides that a new war between Israel and Hezbollah might be about to begin. On social media, graphic scenes of violence are everywhere, available to everyone. The Israeli government posted video that purports to show body cam footage of a Hamas militant shooting at a civilian vehicle and a dash cam video from inside the car. VOA could not independently confirm the authenticity of the video. The unfiltered and sometimes false information fuels mutual hatred that is becoming more intense and ingrained in people on both sides of this conflict. Nadush Mohammed is a Ramallah resident. She says, these children you see, these quadruplets, their parents waited 16 years to have them. Now they are killed. What did these kids do to Israel? Mohammed lives far from Gaza in a comfortable house in Ramallah. She says she would prefer to be dead than watch what is coming to her phone every day. After seeing it, she says, it's impossible to even think about living in peace with an Israeli. She says, we are different from them. We saw the treatment of Hamas towards children and the treatment of Israel. What they say about the burning of children is not true. Hamas treats its hostages very well. She refers to a video she saw released by the militant group Hamas, claiming it is taking good care of Israeli children it is holding hostage. The content of that video is unverified. For several days, Ramallah's streets have been full of people protesting the Israeli attacks on Gaza. In Israeli communities close to the Gaza border, life has all but stopped. In Ashkelon, the biggest city near Gaza, few go out into the streets. The sirens don't go off as often as they used to at the beginning of the war, but rockets keep coming from Gaza, aimed at them. In this once bustling marina, only a few people came for a stroll on a sunny afternoon. After several days at home, Yana decided to come out for a walk with her boyfriend Nikolai. Their realities are quite different from those of Nadush, but they strangely seem connected by the hatred they express. She says they showed videos of the soldiers who are kidnapped, of children who were pulled from vehicles. They raped girls in the squares in Gaza. I don't think there is a difference between them. They are the same. Yana, like Nadush, doesn't think it will ever be possible for Israelis and Palestinians to coexist after this. She says you cannot live with them in peace. In the end, they will kill us because they are taught in school that we are their enemies. Yana refers to videos she has seen on social media that claim to show Palestinian schools teaching children to view Israelis as their enemies. That content is also unverified. Israelis and Palestinians have both grown up in a culture of mutual hatred and distrust. Many on both sides of this tragedy see death and destruction more than ever as the only solution. For Jan Boschot in Jerusalem, Marcus Harden, VOA News.
And that wraps it up for this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Premier Gawu by Magic System. We've been listening to Premier Gawu by Magic System. I am your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington, and on behalf of our engineer, Patrick Dea, and producer, Kwame Afori, thank you for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.